Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session. Pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning, may be seated. First case on our calendar, 001214, Georgine M. Anderson versus Highland House Company. Mr. Malott.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I would like to leave this panel with one main thought today, and that's that in interpreting an insurance policy, you don't necessarily have to agree with the other side. If there are the possibility of two reasonable readings of policy language, then under the rules of construction of this court and many others in Ohio, the law says that you've got to give effect to the reasonable reading that results in coverage for the policyholder. And in this particular case, dealing with the pollution exclusion of this policy, I believe that in the setting that we have in this case, where you have carbon monoxide injuries in a residential apartment building, that exclusion may reasonably be read in this particular case so as to not apply to exclude coverage for those injury claims. Now, this is seen because of the, number one, the great split of authority that exists around the country on this very specific issue. And as this court itself held, it's an old case, but it's still good law, the George Olmsted case, where courts of differing jurisdictions read the same language and come to differing conclusions, the question of whether the language is ambiguous ceases to be an open one. And I think that that is very much the case here, because we've got many different courts across the country looking at the same identical language and reaching different conclusions, some finding this exclusion applies to exclude coverage, others finding that it does not exclude coverage. The reason for this is that it flows from the policy language itself, which I think should be the starting point. And a few points of significance there I would like to note. This particular pollution exclusion nowhere mentions carbon monoxide or residential heating units or furnaces.
But you can't disagree, can you, that if we just take the words of the policy, that they do include carbon monoxide, do they not?
I understand the question, and that is one reasonable reading that a person could give to it, but I think that because of the words of art, the environmental terms of art that are used, and the lack of any specific mention of carbon monoxide, a court or a person reading this could reasonably conclude that this was meant to apply to environmental types of pollution claims. In other words,
well,
the large...
You do make a statement in your briefs, of course, there's a strong argument that exactly that we have to look at the context and the history of why this language appears in contracts. But I just wanted to sort of see if we could narrow the issue. That does seem to me that the words, if you just take the words without knowing anything else, that carbon monoxide fits within the words, and that doesn't end the question.
It could be read that way, and I agree with you. Okay. It does not end the question, because I can make the same argument under this same language, carrying it to its logical extreme, that a puddle of water on the lobby floor of the Highland House Apartments, if somebody slipped and fell on that, the pollution exclusion could also be applied by the insurance company to exclude coverage for that, because water's a chemical compound. It's two atoms of hydrogen and one atom of oxygen.
Could it be said that this language is not ambiguous, but that interpreting it, it doesn't apply?
I think that, yes, I think that that's one result that the court could reach, to say that it's not ambiguous in the sense that it clearly was meant to apply only to the large-scale type of industrial pollution, like a plant or a factory that, you know, belches smoke or discharges, you know, waste into the rivers or streams.
I thought that's what your first proposition of law went to.
That is part of our argument. It's not the only part of our argument. We do think that it only applies to the industrial type of pollution. And when you look at the language and how it tracks actually some of the environmental regulations and laws, they use words like migration, seepage, dispersal. Those are all environmental terms of art. And I think that anyone looking at it could reasonably conclude from that the intent was to only exclude pollution injury claims or damages resulting from industrial type pollution.
It could be unambiguous and not applicable.
Yes, I believe that that's also a result. The reasonableness of our reading of this also, I think, is shown in light of the purpose. When we look to the purpose of this type of exclusion, the historical purpose, as we've cited in many cases, the origin of this deals with, again, not rewarding, not encouraging, not condoning, not covering the classic environmental type pollution claims. In this particular case, because it's an exclusion, the carrier has the burden of proof, and there's been no showing made by the carrier here that there was any contrary meeting of the minds, that there was any contrary purpose of the parties reached. The files of Indiana Insurance Company itself are very telling because it gave inconsistent readings to this same exclusion, showing that itself either didn't understand it or applied it inconsistently. What Indiana did here was adopt an ISO exclusion, its insurance services organization, and the internal memos show an exchange, which we put before the court, that Indiana itself said we may never know what the original drafting intent was behind this in the context of covering carbon monoxide type claims of this nature. And also in there you'll see that Indiana itself, despite this pollution exclusion, was still offering to cover injury claims from school science labs where there's chemicals. Also was covering paint overspray claims where a contractor may be painting a bridge and the wind blows some of the paint spray onto cars. They were paying those kinds of claims.
Well, that's still part of your argument that it is not ambiguous and not applicable.
Yes, okay. That's absolutely correct.
I think that you've made that clear and you've briefed that well, and also the ambiguous question. Are you going to get at some point to the reasonable expectations test?
Yes, I am. I think one of the amicus briefs cites that Ohio is in the minority with respect to reasonable expectations.
That was my concern. It says 39 states have adopted it. The other side says, well, that's not so. What's the truth?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I haven't done a count myself. But I believe that Ohio is in a distinct minority with respect to that because many of the cases that we have cited specifically in the context of this case do use language that suggests that the courts there were looking at the reasonable expectations of the policyholder. Now, I don't think that it's necessary to reach the result that I asked this court to reach by adopting the reasonable expectations test here, but it is another way that this court, should it adopt that test, can reach the same result. I think that what we put forth under the traditional insurance analysis would serve this court in reversing the Court of Appeals.
How do the courts that have adopted the reasonable expectation doctrine, how do they respond to the complaint that that leaves in the hands of the mind of the insured the ability to determine what the coverage is going to be?
I don't believe, as I have read those cases, Judge, that it's a purely subjective test where the policyholder after the fact can self-servingly say, oh gee, I thought that this would be covered. As I understand the test, it's what an objective policyholder could reasonably understand the language to mean upon reading the policy. And in this particular case, we have corroborating evidence, so it's not just purely, you know, Herb Chisling's subjective opinion after the fact in his affidavit, which we put into the record of this case, but there's also evidence that the Indiana insurance agent who sold this policy to Mr. Chisling prior to the loss occurring here had had discussions with Indiana and had taken a different view than that of Mr. Scholl, who's with Indiana. And the agent, Mr. Schneider, had said that in his opinion, under the existing language, this type of claim would be covered, and that's pre-loss. So that corroborates Mr. Chisling's belief that this exclusion would only apply to industrial type pollution. Also, I think that this is a key point on reasonable expectations. Apart from looking at the policy language and reading this as many environmental terms of art that would lead one to believe it applies to industrial pollution, you've also got the Indiana Insurance Company risk assessment audit that was done at the time this policy was underwritten. And in there, Indiana Insurance Company asked the policyholder whether there were any carbon monoxide detectors on the premises. And the answer was written in that application. I think by inquiring about the existence of carbon monoxide detectors, Indiana itself has helped create an expectation on the part of the insured here that a carbon monoxide claim of this type would and should be covered. I would ask, based on this, that the court reverse the Court of Appeals, finding this specific instance that the pollution exclusion does not apply to carbon monoxide claims in a residential setting, and I would like to reserve whatever time I have left, maybe 2 or 3 minutes for rebuttal.
When and how did the first time did the reasonable expectations test arise in this case?
When and how? It arose in the trial level. I believe it was in the briefing on the summary judgments. In that case, I believe my opponent had pointed out that many of the cases that we cited from other jurisdictions appeared to be following this reasonable expectations test, and that sort of crystallized the issue. We responded to that, as I recall, by saying that we searched Ohio law, and some courts here have apparently applied it, some haven't, but this court had never addressed it before.
So the test, the issue, was raised by your worthy adversary.
I believe that's correct.
Okay.
Working off memory here.
Is it also accurate, as I read the trial court's opinion, that the trial court never discussed the issue at all?
I would have to look at the opinion. I'm not sure that the court really, I don't think the trial court founded its decision on that. I think it relied on traditional.
No, it founded its decision on the fact that the policy was ambiguous.
Yeah. See, in my mind, Judge, this reasonable expectations test, although I understand the articulation of it is a bit different, is not that far a cry from what this court already does when it ascertains the intent of the parties. Part of the intent of the parties is what could a reasonable person expect from reading the policy. And actually, this court in the past has talked about the intent of the parties test. That's actually kind of a myth in the insurance setting, because there really is no intent of the parties when an insurance company sells a policy to the policyholder. The language is there. Most of it's on pre-printed forms, unless it's a manuscript policy. And there's usually very little or no negotiation over specific terms. These policies can be, you know, inches thick. As a practical matter, nobody ever reads them. So to talk about what the intent of the parties was is really kind of a myth. The question is, under the facts of the case, how is this policy going to be applied? In this case, I think it should be applied so that Highland House should have coverage. And if I've got any time left, I'd like to reserve it.
Thank you, Mr. Millett.
Thank you.
Mr. Green.
Good morning. May it please the court, on behalf of the appellee, we have two issues to talk about. The first being the pollution exclusion and the fact that it is clear and unambiguous. The second being that this court should not adopt the reasonable expectations doctrine as a manner of construing policies. Let me speak first to the pollution exclusion. As the court knows, the language that we're talking about is very simple. It's the first portion of exclusion F of the typical CGL and the one that was in effect here. Bodily injury arising out of actual escape, seepage, migration of pollutants at or from premises that are owned by the insured. The definition of pollutant is any gaseous or any gaseous irritant or contaminant, which includes vapors and fumes. It has been our position, starting in the trial court and consistently through the Court of Appeals, that there is absolutely nothing ambiguous about that. Even applying it to the set of facts that we have in this case involving carbon monoxide, the record is, I think, unchallenged that carbon monoxide is a pollutant that meets the definition in the policy. There is no question but what the carbon monoxide was at premises that were owned by an insured. There is no question but what the carbon monoxide caused a bodily injury. There is no ambiguity, so therefore there is nothing to construe.
Would there have been coverage if these individuals were injured or died from smoke inhalation that was a result of fire?
Your Honor, there is an exception to the pollution exclusion that is called the hostile fire exception. You're asking me a hypothetical circumstance, and I'm not sure that I can fully embrace it, but yes, there is something else.
The reason that I ask that is because it says pollutants mean, et cetera, including smoke. So I was just wondering if these people were injured from smoke, if we would be here today and you would be presenting the same.
Well, I think the answer is that it depends upon the specific factual context, because if it is smoke other than from a hostile fire, which is an exception to the exclusion, then I believe that the exclusion might well apply if the smoke is deemed to be a contaminant or an irritant in that context. And certainly we could have carbon monoxide, of course, in its benign state in a chemistry lab, for example, where it's not a contaminant, it's not an irritant, it's just there. And that doesn't trigger the situation.
I guess there's never anything new under the sun, but I thought that this was a new and unique case when I started looking at it. I mean, how many people are killed by release of carbon monoxide from a furnace in an apartment, and you have the pollution exclusion at issue? This has happened all around the country.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And with mixed results, obviously.
I think I've found, but mostly they say carbon monoxide is not under the pollution exclusion, don't they?
Your Honor, like Mr. Malott, I haven't done a count, but what I can tell you is that the cases that I think we have brought to the court's attention, all the cases.
There. His count was on the reasonable expectation.
Yes, sir.
Test.
Yes, sir. I'm
That's
saying.
Different than you're tired about
right.
now, isn't it?
But we have brought to the court's attention, I think, all of the significant authority. And if you look at the Florida Supreme Court's decision in Denny, which is not exactly the same facts, but it's very similar because you have an ammonia spill situation. If you look at the Maryland Supreme Court in the Bernhardt case, and if you look at Pennsylvania in the Reliance Insurance case, these are all similar situations where you have a court that has a history of jurisprudence similar to Ohio's, where we look first at the question, is the policy ambiguous? We apply the unambiguous language to the set of facts and decide whether the exclusion is applicable or not.
Didn't you think that the Stoney case out of the Second Circuit was pretty well reasoned?
Well, Your Honor, that's a tough question to answer. Yes, reading the opinion, it certainly is well written. I'm not quarreling with the style of writing of the judge. But the threshold issue has to be, is there an ambiguity in the policy? And then we never reach the issues that the Stoney Court reaches if we decide there's no ambiguity, just as this court did in Highbud. Now, that's not exactly the same exclusion, but it's darn close. You had some additional words in that exclusion that you were looking at that time, the sudden and accidental language. But essentially, you were looked at the same exclusion as has every other appeals court in the state of Ohio. that has looked at this situation has found it is not an ambiguous policy. It is clear. It is easy to apply to the circumstances. We can make a determination that it's effective. One other thing I'd like to mention about the pollution exclusion, two other things, actually. First of all, we don't have a record in this case as to the historical context. What we have are some citations to other decisions based upon evidence that wasn't presented in our case. Secondly, this court, I know, is aware from reading the briefs that this is a very narrow problem in a sense, because in March of 1997, the insurance industry in Ohio, offered a product that for the first time addressed this specific problem. And there is a endorsement available for someone such as Highland House to purchase, which provides coverage for this exact situation at an appropriate premium with appropriate underwriting. So this is not an issue that should reoccur before this court or other courts of Ohio, assuming that the marketplace continues to serve that demand.
You say there's a separate coverage attachment that could be purchased.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Does that argue then for this exclusion being unrelated to that? It seems that then that the exclusion maybe. It seems maybe argued that the exclusion has an environmentally related basis.
Well, I understand your question, but I believe the way this came together is that we had the CGL with this standard pollution exclusion in response to inquiry from the marketplace to provide coverage for this piece of the business that was excluded. There was
a response. Your point would be it would argue that that the two are. It was brought forth because the exclusion indeed did foreclose that coverage.
Exactly.
Okay.
And it was in response to an awareness in the state of Ohio that there wasn't coverage for this type of a situation, and a desire by property owners to have the coverage, and a willingness by the insurance industry to find a way to write the coverage. So yeah. Now you have...
Counsel, you said in the state of Ohio, is this language standard language used in the policies throughout the country?
Are you asking me about the pollution exclusion or
yes.
The new endorsement?
No, the pollution exclusion.
Substantially identical in many policies across the country.
Okay. So when you said it was determined that with this coverage, with this exclusion, there wasn't coverage in Ohio, that implies that with the same language in some other states, there was coverage, presumably because a court had looked at the language and said there is coverage.
There are other jurisdictions, other state jurisdictions, that have read this language and come to a different conclusion. It is my belief, based upon a review of the case authority, that they get there because they start at a different place than we do.
Okay. And at this point, there really isn't a controlling case interpreting this exact language.
There are, in Ohio, there is no controlling case. Yes, sir. HIBUD is the closest we have from this court, and it encompasses this language, but the focus of HIBUD was on the sudden and accidental language. What I'd like to point out, though, is that every intermediate appellate court in Ohio has read the language the same way that the Cuyahoga County Court of Appeals read it in our case. Consistently, the courts of Ohio have said this is not an ambiguous provision. Let me turn to the reasonable expectations issue. My perspective on this is that we have a well-settled rule. I've been practicing in this state predominantly in the area of insurance law for 25 years. I've always known when I got here how you were going to deal with an ambiguous insurance policy. My clients know that. The insureds know that. If there's an ambiguity in the policy, just like any contractual situation, it's going to be construed against the drafter. And the drafter is invariably the insurance company, and so therefore the ambiguity is going to be construed against the insurer and in favor of the insured. The appellants have not offered any reason why we should change that longstanding rule that we all understand and we can all apply. Sometimes we don't like the way it comes out, but we all understand how it works and we can all apply it. No one has offered us a rationale as to why we should change from that policy to something different. In looking at the suggested something different, what is proposed in the briefs here is something that no state adopts, and that is a rule of reasonable expectations based upon the after event recollection of the insured as to what it is they thought they were buying or wanted to buy at the time. And Mr. Chisling's affidavit, I think, is an illustration of how that can go awry. It's far too easy to unsettle the insurance marketplace entirely if you were going to rely upon what an insured says after they've sustained a loss. I mean, obviously the reasonable expectation becomes, I expected to be covered for all my losses. That's why I paid all that money to that insurance company.
Mr. Green says it is not, I'm sorry, Mr. Malott says it is not that subjective, that it is objective, and that you look at communications perhaps between the insured and the insurer and try to develop a understanding of appreciation for what the insured thought it or he or she was getting. Would you dispute that?
Well, Chief Justice Moyer, what I would say is that the briefs that have been submitted by appellant and by its amicus suggest to the contrary that it is a subjective test. However, if you look at the states which have adopted this rule, I agree with Mr. Malott's interpretation that the typical version of the rule is not simply looking at what the insured says, I wish I had bought, but it's looking at something that is described as the reasonable expectations of the reasonable insured at that point. And so then you get into an analysis of, is it reasonably within the public expectation that carbon monoxide would be included in the definition of pollutant in an insurance policy? Well, if today and here and now it's not, then we're not going to have coverage for it. If, on the other hand, next week it is, then we are going to have coverage for it.
Counsel, could you give me a take on how that would cut if the insured and the insurance agent both agree that when the insured and the selling agent got together, the insured said, I want to buy complete coverage. You know, I own these rental units and I don't want any gaps. I want to be covered. I want to be able to sleep at night because there are 40 people sleeping at night in my units. So protect me, and I want to be protected up to X. How would the reasonable expectation doctrine cut if that conversation had taken place?
If it's the reasonable expectations doctrine that comes from some of the state's jurisprudence, that I don't think that conversation matters. I think the interpretation of the policy at that point is, what is the popular understanding of the terms used in the policy? If it's the reasonable expectations doctrine that is argued for in appellant's brief, then it becomes a after-the-fact swearing match as to what is or isn't included in the policy. If it's this court's rule, which has been in effect for so many years, the first question is the policy ambiguous? If the policy is not ambiguous, it doesn't matter. If the policy is ambiguous, then we're going to look at the language of the policy and we're going to construe it to maximize the coverage for the insured. That's a workable rule we understand how to use.
With regard to the reasonable expectations doctrine, one of the amicus briefs affirmatively says 39 states, not including Ohio, have recognized some variation of the reasonable expectations doctrine. I haven't seen that any place directly opposed or explained. Where might I find that is my first question. The second question is, why wouldn't we why should we not adopt the restatement, section 213, where it provides where the other party has reason to believe that the party manifested such assent would not do so if he knew that the writing contained a particular term, the term is not part of the agreement. Why shouldn't we adopt the restatement second of contract?
Justice Douglas, the reference in the amicus brief to the 39 states comes from a review article, and that's that author's interpretation. My sense of it is that they are including states that have language in some of their opinions that where the word reasonable is used. For example, Justice Sweeney wrote an opinion just a couple of weeks ago in Davidson, where the word reasonable appears in the context of expectations, but I don't think that this court was advocating in that opinion adopting a reasonable expectations test. So it's all how you count it. To answer your question specifically on the restatement issue, the answer is because we have a rule, Your Honor, that works in Ohio with respect to construction of contracts, and we all understand it. It works real well. And we understand that if there's an ambiguity in the contract, it's going to be construed against the drafter. That's a broad legal principle with sweeping application, and it applies very specifically to insurance contracts, sometimes to the insurer's chagrin. But this court has always been able to apply it very effectively, and I think the lower courts as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Green. Mr. Millott, you've saved a little over a minute and a half of your time.
I have just several quick comments. Justice Douglas mentioned the Stony Run case, which talks about what a reasonable policyholder's understanding would be of irritants in one context versus another. And I would just give you an everyday hypothetical example. You know, if somebody burns something on the stove and there's smoke that comes from it, you know, the people who are in the house don't go running around saying, gee, where's all this pollution coming from? They say, what's causing all that smoke? But yet you could be driving down the highway going past the steel mills, and if you see smoke coming out of smokestacks, people in the car are going to say, hey, look at that pollution. And it's all a matter of the context and where you're coming from. And somebody who's not in the business of industry, manufacturing, where you've got these kind of waste products, they're not ordinarily going to be thinking of this exclusion in the residential setting. That leads into the restatement. Justice Douglas again put his finger on that quote, and I won't restate it, but it's very interesting that in this case we have facts that are very close to applying that, because here we put into the record an internal memo of Indiana Insurance Company where they're talking to themselves, and one guy writes, no apartment owner in his right mind would want to be without this coverage for carbon monoxide in the residential setting. But
why would an apartment owner who purchases an insurance policy that has this broad language suggest to the agent or to whoever that this doesn't appear to protect me if my furnace leaks and somebody, a tenant, dies? I mean, the language on its face is very broad, and it would seem to me that the answer to that is, as Mr. Green perhaps suggests, that if there's a rider that can be put on a policy to say that the exclusion doesn't apply to X, isn't that the solution?
Well, they did do that after the fact, and I didn't stress that too much. I could make the argument that the rider that they issued after the fact, which wasn't available at the time my client purchased this policy, actually was meant to clarify what was already the case, which was that there was no intent to exclude coverage for carbon monoxide. But again, that was after this policy was issued and after the accident that became available. So, I mean, that would be one way to deal with it, but first the policyholder, Justice Moyer, has to first think to ask that question. And if you've got an apartment owner who has an older apartment building, he's got to be thinking in terms of, oh, gee, well, what if one of these furnaces leaks? Is the carbon monoxide going to come into this pollution exclusion?
Does the agent have to tell him about that important area that's not covered?
I believe that the agent should, but I think agents are limited to what they can do. I think in a general way, an agent should properly advise. In this particular case, we know that we had an agent who believed that carbon monoxide would be covered under this, but agents also, I believe, have to rely on information from the insurance company as well. There's a myriad of circumstances that could come up under this, and I think that it's something that most people would not understand to be the case.
You've used your time, Mr. Millett.
Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.